is Jeff Seymour, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I'm going to give you a brief history of traditional acting training, and then discuss why it's time to move on. I'll explain. I think one of the reasons that people are so stuck with this traditional training, and when I say traditional training, I mean the stuff that was, well, kind of created in the middle of the last century, let's say from basically, maybe the 30s up through the late 60s. I think there's an idea that, you know, acting was invented then, and that those notable teachers, those historic teachers that we all know so well, kind of created acting and then created the instruction booklet for how acting needed to be done. And of course, this is not true, because acting has been around since, well, I think since the dawn of man. I believe that there very well could have been a cavemen sitting around a fire after a mastodon hunt. And there was probably one particular caveman who was always very good at acting out aspects of the mastodon hunt and would perhaps entertain the other cavemen. I think when the other cavemen saw little Gonko come near the fire, they knew they were in for an evening of mirth, merriment, and mastodon meat. Why not? I think laughter was probably then, and people figured out how to get to laughter. Certainly, we know that the Greeks, as far back as 5th century BC, there were playwrights writing plays. It was a different thing. You know, they had one person, the protagonist, with maybe 50 people in a chorus behind helping tell the story, and then that evolved to then where there was a protagonist and an antagonist, and then that chorus was reduced down to 10 or 15 people, and things kind of went on from there. We certainly know about Shakespeare, and so acting has been around for a long, long time. What was acting like? Who knows? Who knows what these plays were like that Shakespeare did? But we do know that Hamlet gave advice to the players. Now, forgive me, I'm not a Shakespearean chap, but from my recollection, and I may be paraphrasing, I believe it was something like, "Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of our players do, I just assume the town crier spoke my lines." Now, obviously what he's saying is he doesn't want his actor to stand and just blare the words out like they've recited something. They want you to be trippingly on the tongue, and I would take that to mean like the way conversation was spoken those days. Also, he said this business about, nor saw the air too much with your hand thusly, and, showing just some sort of, overdone gesticulation. He added, suit the word to the action to the word. I mean, obviously, there was an awareness of good acting and bad acting even back then. Now, who knows what that was, but we do know that when they first started recording it, which I think was 1903, and I believe that they would have said the first silent film would have been The Great Train Robbery. As far as a film went, well, there was no sound, as we know, hence silent film. And they would generally be accompanied with some sort of live music played. I'm sure most of you know this, to help with tension and whatever of watching of the silent film. Now, I think that when the filmmakers were making these films and it was silent, it would stand to reason that they would want to make sure the audience got it. You know, we couldn't read lips. And so it would stand to reason that things would have been over-exaggerated. Hence the girl that was put in danger with the long, curly blonde locks. And, you know, when they tied her up, you know, they basically put her in a cocoon of rope so that we could get, she wasn't going anywhere. And then we tie her to the train track, and then we see the train, and we can create tension with the train getting closer. And then we have the bad guy, and the bad guy is dressed in black, and he has a top hat, and he has a big, long mustache, and he can twirl the mustache. And he can, you know, gesticulate to the camera, and everybody can gesticulate, much like a proscenium arch to the camera of what's going on. And then we can have the good guy, who would more than likely be in white, and he could be on a white horse, and he could come up, and then he could help, and then they could get the bad guy. And, you know, this stuff, by their reasoning, had to be over-exaggerated. And you had to make the stuff very, very descriptive so that the visual would let the audience know what was going on. And then with a placard that could be put up with, you know, what is written out for people to read, and then with the accompanied music, we could follow the show and feel the tension and release when we needed to. And then, I think in 1927, we had The Jazz Singer, which is the first film that we call a talkie. And even though there were a few films after that done that still were silent, now we come into the era of talking films. Well, guess what? I don't think that suddenly, naturally, everyone, now that they could speak, suddenly found themselves acting as they might have acted in everyday life. No, there would still be this pull to, you know, present what was going on. That proscenium arch was still there. We're still presenting for the camera. And things were, by certainly real life standards and certainly by today's standards, quite phony if you watch them. You know, there was a way that everyone spoke. They called it the Mid-Atlantic dialect. And that's when you'd have these people walk in and say, "Hello, darling." And, "Oh, hello, Tom." And, you know, and then when somebody would faint, they'd put the back of their hand to their forehead and, yeah, fall back. And that was the style. That's kind of what it was. And we accepted it. You watched it. That's what you accepted. Now, there were factions of people, now that we were recording this stuff, you see, that now that they could sit and watch it collectively on screen, you see, they could see what was being presented to the masses. They could sit and say, now that we've recorded something, say, "But that's not real life. That's not what it looks like." So you had factions, schools of thought, decidedly approaching acting differently, like the Moscow Art Theater, the Group Theater in 1931 with Harold Klurman and a very young Lee Strasberg. And the whole idea was to go at certainly socially relevant plays and presentations, but the idea was, you know, really going toward naturalism. They wanted things to feel and taste and seem like real life. And then as we got into the 40s and the 50s, certainly, we now had the Actors Studio beginning in 1947, with Lee Strasberg taking over in 1951. We had Stella Adler founding her studio in 1949. And these people were all trying to break down what real life really was, you see? Because to anyone who cared about such a thing, you see, you could, now that things were being recorded, you could watch it, you could say, well, nobody really walks into a room and says, "Hello, darling." Nobody spoke like that in real life. That was the sound, that was the accepted kind of dialect that they did in these films and presentations. What happens? Well, we know that somebody like Elia Kazan comes along and he does films like Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando. Now, you know, Marlon Brando was his own guy. Marlon Brando was not going to walk into a room and say, "Hello, darling," you know. It's a, you know, well, you know, and that was how he was. He was himself. He was irreverent. And that attracted the attention of other actors. Famously, of course, James Dean, and then there was Montgomery Clift and Barbara Stanwyck, and then Geraldine Page. There were these actors that started working at that time with Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg, and they all started going toward this idea of, you know, you got to be yourself. You know, what is reality? certain exercises were conjured and created, you see, because they needed to. Because the knee-jerk reaction to acting would have been that dialect, the fakeness, the awareness of a proscenium arch, of performing for the camera, of still the residuals of an overacted for camera and the audience presentation that had its beginnings in silent films. And so we had all these wonderful teachers that came along, and they really needed to kind of stamp that out. And the best way to stamp that out would have been to break it down. And so all sorts of exercises were created. Time was taken, you see, because they needed to stop people in their tracks. You walk into a room, hello, is that what you do? Now, so let's do this. Let's sit in a chair and let's feel the sun on your face. Now, this may seem very remedial and elementary, but that's where it started. What is it like to drink a hot cup of coffee? You've got a cup, it's not hot, but show me. They created things like, you know, private moments, personal moments, where the exercise would be the actor comes in and shows the class what they do when they're shaving, when they're at home, the way they fix their toast, whatever. And of course, these things went off the deep end with all sorts of nonsense that then people would show in class that, you know, you shouldn't necessarily be showing anyone. But that's what happened, you see. It was reaction to a style of work that needed to be stopped. And again, because what we had grown up with was this, at that time, this over-exaggeration, and because there were these people, and then Una Hagen, of course, and, you know, people like Eric Morris and Sanford Meisner, you know, they were all saying, you know, we need to break it down. We need to get you back to your instincts. You know, these were all really, really, really good ideas at the time. Needed ideas. Yes. And you see, then it became the thing to go deep. You know, what is real emotion? I mean, you could go back and look at any of these old films and watch somebody when they cried. Very rarely, if you really stopped and looked at it, would you think that the person was actually breaking down. There'd be somebody going, I've had it, I tell you, I've had it. And they'd just make these noises and then collapse against the wall and slide down it in a big heap. We accepted it. You can still watch one of these old films. And it's, you know, it's still fun. But come now, if we took one of those moments out and put it here in real life, I mean, it would seem like some crazy historically acted, you know, thing. So it seemed there was a need to put the brakes on and get to a grounded reality. So these exercises were a way to do that. But then it almost became a challenge to see how deep you could go, how deep inside you could go. That's kind of what happened, you see. Then it became internal, and that became the fad. You know, let's do some emotional work. Let's really break it down. Let's really get into it. Let's do this crazy psychotherapy shit that no one should be doing in class. Let's get to the raw emotion. You know, let's really just rip the scab off and, you know, go at it. It was needed at the time. But acting in cinema kept evolving, and soon that 30s, 40s phoniness in acting went away. And as we got toward the end of the 60s and you had, you know, The Graduate, or you had Midnight Cowboy with John Voight and, of course, Dustin Hoffman, and Dustin Hoffman, of course, in The Graduate, you had Mike Nichols, who was so smart about all this stuff. And as we got into the 70s and we found Al Pacino and Robert De Niro and you know, Mean Streets and Scorsese and Robert Altman, you know, as things progressed with directors, and certainly a lot of European directors that were hitting it right on the head, what we came to mostly enjoy and want to award were these very naturalistic, very real performances. And then certainly as the 70s went on, the 80s, the 90s, and then now here we are in the 21st century, Yeah, hyperrealism, baby. I mean, that's what we award these days. We kind of award the absence of acting. You know, there are still some grandiose actors out there, but I would say they're kind of grandiose people. They're old school, the old guard, who just have a certain magnificence that I think they have in everyday life, and that comes to their work. I mean, I love Christopher Plummer's work, certainly. But, you know, you can almost say that that kind of harkens back to an old time, but I think that it only does in the sense that I think in everyday life, he is this magnificent old cat. And he brings that to his work. But the reality in the moments, I think, are as good as anyone's. The actors that we tend to revere today are the ones that seem to be absent of any acting. So for years, since I've been teaching now since 1980, I would say, why do we continue to use these old school ideas? Nobody is bucking the trend. Certainly by now, most actors that walk into a class try their best to be seamless from the way they're behaving before the scene starts and into the scene. Wouldn't you agree? Isn't that what we all try to do? In fact, many times you go to an audition and the casting director or assistant will come out and say, hey, listen, the director doesn't want any acting, no acting. Don't they do not want to see acting in there. I mean, what are we talking about? No acting? I'm playing a serial murderer. I'm playing a dirty cop. I'm playing a priest. I'm none of these things. Of course I'm going to be acting. I'm not making up these lines. No, what they're saying is they want it to be seamless. They don't want acting. So that's accepted, right? That's what makes it so brilliant these days. Could we agree on this? Okay. Well then, if we could agree on that, then you see my question, what I'm confounded with is, why do we keep using all of these old school techniques? They were created at a certain time to solve a certain problem. They were created to get people to a place of reality that they weren't going to when they stood up to act because they had been steeped in this kind of fake acting stuff. Mostly, you see, the problem I have is that the exact wrong thing to do is to get actors to think about acting, get them in their head, and then ask them to magically pretend like they haven't been talking about acting and then magically not think about all that stuff. Here's my fundamental issue. The very thing that you don't want to be caught doing, why would we discuss it? Anything that gets you in your head, all of it. You know, again, the whole idea of breaking it down into beats or, you know, any sort of emotional inventory exercise or substitution or, you know, movement work. I love that shit. Yeah, movement work, if you've had a major accident, yes, you need to do movement work. You've broken both of your legs and, you know, one of your arms and, you fractured three ribs and now you're on your feet. Yes. Obviously, unless you're going to play recently messed up physically people, you're going to need to get going again. So we need to do movement work. But I wonder about the movement work. Well, you got a problem with movement in life? You have issues? Then you need to see a physical therapist. But let's pretend for a moment that, no, you hop out of bed in the morning and you know how to run and jog and you go to the gym or whatever. You sit at your home, but you can move around. People don't say, ooh, wow, what's up there? You got knee problems? What are you doing movement work for? What is movement work? Now, look, is movement important? Sure, listen, exercise, eat well, get plenty of sleep. I believe in yoga and hot yoga and Pilates and everything else. But to tell me that I need to do that in order to act, you see, that's my problem. You see, this is another hoodwink. You see, what it is it's a culture of telling actors that you've got to do all of these things before you get to do that. You've heard me say this over and over again, and this is what I don't like. Now, if you're not graceful, or if you, I don't know, you know, you're all thumbs, and you got two left feet, and you want to go take a movement class so that maybe you can find your center and get some more core strength so that you can move more gracefully. Yes. Yes, absolutely. Tally-ho. But if that isn't a problem, you see, I think what happens is this is how I confuse you and distract you, and I make you believe by lording over your head, I thought you wanted to be an actor. I'm sorry, I thought you were committed. I mean, you think it's easy to become a movie star? Or you think you just walk into Hollywood and say, here I am? No, you got to do the work. So you need to do a movement exercise. You need to get on your breath. You need to break your scene down into beats. You need to do a backstory, and on and on and on. And mostly, and I'd say almost 99% of the time, the people that teach this stuff have never had any success doing it as an artist. They will tell you they've had success doing it as a teacher. But you see, I believe that the people that come along that are talented, they will get where they're going in spite of the nonsense that you've taught them. This has to stop. We're doing antiquated bullshit exercises, dissections, you know, ponderings of things that were thought up in the middle of the last century to tackle a problem we no longer have. So then, what is acting for the 21st century? What is this thing that I lay out all the time, go on, and that I will repeat again and again and again? Why is it not obvious that if we're trying to replicate real life, if that is our goal, if what we're trying to do is portray that as real life, human beings, no acting, please, give me the real stuff, walk into the audition, I want to see the real person, I want to feel like this actually happened, I want to feel like this is personal to you, that this is something, you're not acting for me, you're not showing me what it could be like, you know, this is it, that's what we hire. Doesn't it make sense that then why do we need to talk about acting? When I'm discussing your scene, why do we break it down into acting? You've had discussions with people about a conflict in your life. You don't break it down into acting. You've talked about something before you went in to talk to your wife who you think's cheating on you, or husband you think's cheating on you, or your boss who's been stealing from you or whatever. You talk it over with friends. Why can't we use that same method? I could still say to you, well, what's really bothering you, George? What's up? Well, why are you so upset? Well, why do you think it's her fault? Well, tell me about it. You see, you're already now owning in real time the problem as you would in life. And the beauty of this is, now I don't have to say to you, okay, forget everything we just said and go in there. Now, you see, my philosophy is I'm only going to talk about the things I want you to remember. Then you don't have to remember to forget something. Why do I want you to do that? Oh, you forgot to forget. Otherwise, the audition would have been great, but you forgot to forget. Can you not hear that? Can you not see how truly useless this way of working is? So, why do we keep doing it? Because that's the way it's always been done. Because it's written somewhere. Because someone who taught someone 60 years ago said it was so. You know, I've told this anecdote. It's in my book, and it's but it bears repeating at this very moment. I had the pleasure of apprenticing with a brilliant English mechanic named Bill Crook when I was a kid, 17, for the summer. I followed him around. I watched everything he did. He taught me everything I know about tools and cars, and he really planted the seed. And to this day, you know, not a day goes by when I'm working on an old car, I don't think about Bill. One day at the end of the day. We would always clean everything up, and that was certainly a big part of my job. I noticed a large box of tools that had these crazy tools sticking out of it. They literally didn't fit in the box, and they were poking out, and very odd things. And I pulled out this, like, 2.5-foot screwdriver that was bent, and at the end, crudely welded, but for strength, was then a bent wrench. I said, "Bill, what is this?" He said, "Oh, that's for a 72 Alpha. The book gives me 12 hours to change a clutch." He said, "It takes 12 hours because you've got to drop the engine in order to get to the transmission and get to the clutch. And you got to drop the engine because there's one bolt you can't reach." I made that tool, and now I can take that bolt off, and I do the job in 3 hours instead of 12. I realized this man that I admired so much was telling me, "Look, kid, just because something is in a book, and just because everyone does it that way, doesn't mean that you can't come up with a more efficient, more effective way to do it." So I guess what I'm saying is, you don't need to drop the engine to change the clutch. I have a tool for that. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to a Real Life Actor podcast. This is Jeff Seymour. Please remember to follow us on Podomatic or subscribe on iTunes. If you want to know anything else about the Real Life Actor approach, you can always go to reallifeactor.com. Thanks for listening.